Chapter 6 Nova Class Frigate Forge Hammer. The ship drifted, night black against a starless void. Battle-worn, its hull was ragged and bore stark evidence of a recent hostile engagement. Its engines were dormant and without function, cold like a dead star. Its port and starboard facings were dark, and no heat trace was present in its systems that, for all intents and purposes, were inert. Ostensibly, the Hunter-class destroyer that had recently come into close proximity of the Forge Hammer was dead. Lieutenant Mercator's face betrayed his consternation as he glared at the sensorium feed that described the foreign vessel that had just strayed into their vicinity. His mood failed to improve as he regarded the scratchy picked captures. Incongruity displeased him, and everything about this ship, its sudden appearance and condition, was incongruous. Like a slow-moving ocean predator that plays dead whilst drifting on the currents with the other flotsam, the dark ship had crept up on the larger frigate, as innocuous on the sensorium as an asteroid. It wasn't until the ship could be seen and identified that the alarm had been raised.
"How long have you been aware of this?" Mercator asked pensively, smoothing his moustache and beard.
He was looking over the shoulder of a young officer, overseeing the ship's eyes and ears. The Forge Hammer was currently at silent running, so the bridge was quiet, the many consoles sparsely attended by a skeleton crew and underlit with softly glowing lumens.
"A few minutes, sir. I hailed as soon as I was sure."
"Sure of what, ensign?"
"That it was a ship, sir."
"And what's your assessment now?"
The officer seemed nonplussed.
"It's a wreck, sir. A carcass of a ship, really. It must have drifted into the planet's gravity well and been drawn to us."
"You've detected no motive power at all?"
asked Mercator, whose eyes had yet to leave the screen.
"No, sir."
"No life signs?"
"Not that we can tell, sir. Biorhythmic activity is difficult to accurately gauge at this range, though, and our instruments are not..."
"Then we should take a closer look."
"Yes, sir."
Mercator lifted his gaze from the console at last.
"Not you, ensign," he said, and turned his attention to the broad-shouldered armsman standing at ease behind him. "Jeddah, summon three of your men trained in atmospheric combat."
Jeddah saluted crisply and departed as ordered. The uniform he wore, like all those sworn to the Fireborn aboard the Forge Hammer, was coal black with his rank markings described in grey. Mercator's insignia, as befitted his station, was silver.
"You," said Mercator, facing the officer, "will vox for Engineer Utulex to join us on Launch Deck 6. I want a craft fueled and ready in 20 minutes.
"Us, sir?"
"Yes. I need to stretch my legs."
Mercator was walking away when he paused.
"And tell him to bring the Thalax."
"Sir,"
the ensign ventured somewhat hopefully. Mercator paused again. Though he had his back to the lad, the stiffening of his shoulders intimated his annoyance.
"Should I contact Lord Zarko with news of this discovery?"
Mercator seemed to consider this, relaxing for a moment before stiffening up again and trooping on his way.
"No, do not. The Lord is in his sanctum. We don't need to disturb him with this."
An Arvus lighter was prepped and waiting on Launch Deck 6 for Lieutenant Mercator as per his orders. So too was a squad of armsmen, all kitted out in atmosphere suits. They stood at attention outside the small atmospheric craft, armed with heavy-gauge las guns and handheld plasma cutters. The atmosphere suits were enhanced rubber and plastic. Ugly-looking things and cumbersome, but they were effective. Also present was the engine seer.
Utalex had brought his watchdog, which loomed large and threatening behind the robed servant of the Martian Mechanicus. The Thalax was a battle engine, a hulking cyborg that cradled an immense rifle across its armored torso. It was called a lightning gun, a blunt yet accurate appellation. Through a series of capacitors and power relays, slaved to the Thalax's cyborganic systems, the lightning gun was capable of producing a devastating energy beam that could incapacitate mechanical targets via an extreme overload of power. For organic targets, the effects were somewhat messier and more permanent. Between Jeddah's squad and the combat droid, there was a lot of firepower. In his many years of service aboard the Forge Hammer and the Triumphal before that, Mercato had learned to be cautious, especially when stepping into the unknown. Apart from the Lumen array, which was lighting up the area around the Arvus, the rest of the deck was dark. There were 16 launch bays on this deck in total, all lined up on the flanking wall. All but one was sealed and in shadow. Aft launch bay Theta 7 was lit by a ring of flashing amber emergency lamps. This was Captain Agatone's ship, and while he and the rest of his warriors were off deck, Lord Zarko was in command. In his absence, Kensai Mercato ran things. Though by any military standards his rank was modest, he took great pride in his appointed task. He was in service to a chapter of the Emperor's Angels. In his mind, that was a great and unimpeachable honor. Every serf from armsman to brander priest was his responsibility. In many respects, he was this ship's major domo, its custodian and gamekeeper. Any potential threat to its smooth running, Mercato regarded as his duty to deal with. This ship was but the latest. And besides, as he had told the ensign, he needed to stretch his legs. The last bit of excitement they had experienced was several weeks back when the Vulcan's Wrath had docked with the Forge Hammer, letting Agatone and eight of his men aboard. Zarko was already on deck. The librarian had joined them earlier via shuttlecraft. A course was plotted to Sterndrang, and the rest was kept need to know. For Mercato, that meant their destination, but nothing else. Agatone and his charges had seemed agitated, though, but that was the extent of what was shared with any non-Adeptus Astartes personnel. It didn't matter to Mercato. He knew his duty and would prosecute it to the fullest. If that meant breaking up the monotony of twiddling his thumbs in low orbit above some dirt world he had never heard of and was less than inclined to visit, then so much the better. Descending via pneumatic pressure lift, Mercato reached the deck promptly.
"All is in readiness, Jeddah?" he asked as he reached the others.
"Aye, sir," replied the gruff master-at-arms. "All pre-flight checks have been conducted. Ship is fueled and at your command."
"Then let's get this done."
Mercato paused on the lighter's access ramp before going in.
"You know why you're here?" he asked Utalex. "Explorative mission aboard. Apparently scuppered Hunter-class vessel that has drifted into our immediate vicinity."
The engine seer spoke through a vocalizer grill instead of a mouth. Under his hood, a single optic glowed as its tracking rings focused and refocused on the lieutenant. He was hunched, a result of the heavy cybernetic augmentation his body had undergone during his long tenure, but most of his mechanized enhancements were concealed by expansive brown robes. A Mechanicus sigil, unique to his dominions back on Mars and echoed over the Thalax's black and gunmetal-gray carapace, adorned his priestly vestments.
"You wish to know what is on board, Lieutenant,"
Utalex concluded.
"Correct."
Mercato glanced up at the head of the Thalax. He had to crane his neck quite far to do so. A diode, where its eye might have been, glowed green, signifying passivity.
"Keep that thing quiescent unless it's needed," he warned Utalex. "If there are survivors, I don't want them eradicated before I've had a chance to question them."
"And if they are hostile, Lieutenant?" asked Utalex. "Defend us!"
Makoto led them inside, without further preamble. He had already decided he would fly the craft himself, and once aboard, quickly got strapped into the pilot's station and commenced startup protocols. The others filed in after him, Jeddah in front, and likewise strapped themselves into the crew compartment. Each man checked the rebreather and function of the atmosphere suit to the man on his left. Once satisfied, Jeddah gave the signal for the launch to commence. Seeing that the engine seer and Thalax were also now aboard, Makoto began ignition. Through the lighter's glacis, he saw the amber lumens around the launch portal turn to green as he provided the requisite launch codes. The landing strip was lit. He boosted the shuttle's engines and fired up into launch. 8 seconds, and they had cleared the landing strip and emerged from one of the aft launch ports into the void. 23 kilometers in front of them loomed the dark and lightless shape of the stricken destroyer. As he made course for the massive vessel floating listlessly through space, Makoto found it hard not to think of it as a tomb. He was no coward, far from it. Makoto had served with the Imperial Navy for almost a century and was considered a veteran. But deep down in his marrow, he prayed for the ship to be empty and that nothing was lurking aboard. A damaged fighter bay allowed the Arvus untrammeled access to the Hunter-class vessel. Within seconds of touching down onto an ice-bitten, debris-strewn deck, it was obvious that atmospheric conditions aboard had been severely compromised. Mag-locking the landing stanchions of the lighter, Makoto lowered the ramp and gave the order to disembark. The Thalax led them out, its targeting matrix hazing the zero atmosphere of the deck. Engaging luminator banks on its chest carapace, it spread a thin wash of magnesium-bright light over the void dark interior.
"I'm no expert, sir, but I'd hazard this bay has been damaged by a torpedo impact," said Jeddah through the contrivance of his atmosphere suit's vox.
He cast his own lamp pack over the expansive deck, made larger by depressurization and the subsequent evacuation of all men and materials not bolted down. Evidence of fires, rapidly extinguished, could be seen marring some of the walls, which were also riddled with tiny craters the size of Makoto's fist.
"Some kind of fragmentation warhead," he posited out loud, "shredded the whole deck."
Each man had locked his boots with a moderate magnetic charge, enough to hold on, but not so much that he could not advance. As an additional safety precaution, Makoto had insisted each man be tethered to another. If one experienced magnetic failure, the other would anchor him down until further help could arrive. Only Utalex went without, trusting to the manifold apparatus of his cybernetic implants to keep him grounded. The Thalax had its own terrain adaptive systems that included void combat. It could have traversed the outside of the ship if so commanded.
"Sergeant,"
the engine seer began, using voice amplification and modulation to be heard by the atmosphere-suited humans,
"I have located a route further into the ship."
Makoto turned, slowed by the lack of gravity, and saw the access port Utalex was referring to. It looked like a maintenance hatch, a crawl space just wide enough for the Thalax if it was crouched down. The rest of them should not have any trouble, and there was no way their plasma cutters were going to get through the larger gates and sealed bulkheads that had come down, too late, it seemed, to seal off the launch bay.
"Make it safe, engine seer. We'll proceed in that direction."
Utalex nodded, and with a blurt of binaric cant, sent the Thalax up to take point. At Makoto's order, Jeddah brought up two armsmen with plasma cutters.
Make it quick, he voxed.
6 minutes and they were through the hatch and into the corridor beyond. During that time, Utelek scanned for life signs but found nothing. The Thalax would have been compromised in the narrow access corridor, so Jeddah went in first with his carbine primed. It was snub-nosed and compact, perfect for boarding actions. At close range, Jeddah was confident of its stopping power. On one wall in the 8-meter corridor was a cogitator panel. Utelex force-accessed it using his mechadendrite implants and gained access to some of the ship's onboard systems. First, he rebooted the life support, which had been inexplicably suspended, then used what little emergency reserves remained to provide minimal lighting and motive power to some of the lifters. He then sealed the maintenance corridor behind them with a secondary blast gate that dropped down from the ceiling. Yellow lumens in both walls flickered once and stayed on. The light was weak, but at least it was lit and better than abject darkness. A hissing sound presaged reoxygenation, and in just over 8 minutes, the corridor and the immediate section of the ship beyond it, a small maintenance deck, was habitable again. The corridor was wide enough for two abreast, so Jeddah and Makato were shoulder to shoulder when the exit hatch opened and admitted them deeper into the ship. Jeddah went first, breathing slow and steady through his respirator, blowing out gusts of carbon dioxide through the filtration vents at the sides of his mask. He moved low and stealthy, almost feline, the carbine tucked into his shoulder and panning across the deck. Like the rest of the ship, it was deserted. Squalls of mist ghosted across the floor, obscuring it from view. Lamp packs still flickered as they tried and failed to maintain a consistent link to the ship's recently resupplied emergency power. In the half-light, they saw chains hanging from a vaulted ceiling. A swaying phosphor globe sporadically illuminated a squadron of power lifters. Their cabs bowed down as if in reverence. Lifter arms hung slack by their sides. No crew, though. There were no bodies anywhere, only crates and laid-down tools. Advancing close on Jeddah's heels, Makato paced out the deck in his mind. He guessed 260 meters. Definitely a sub-deck, but the lifter tube at the end of it would grant them further access. He reasoned that any survivors still on board would either be on the bridge or in life support. According to Utelex's scans, this meant heading upwards to the higher decks. Roughly halfway across the maintenance deck, Makato clenched his fist, then raised it to order an all-stop. The boarding party were moving in a column, and there was plenty of space between them and the shadowy confines of the wider deck either side.
Engine Seer, I'm reading some temperature fluctuations. The ship is still normalizing its environment, Utelex replied, his Thalax watchdog standing dutifully over him. Are we safe to remove respirators? Makato asked.
They were fouling his peripheral vision, and if the ship was atmospherically stable from this point, he would prefer to be without the handicap. Utelex took a few seconds to collate and assess the data from across the activated decks.
You may disengage atmospheric redundancies, Sergeant.
Makato unclipped the dome-like glacis from his head and removed it, along with his respirator. The air smelt stagnant, still in the early stages of filtration and recycle, but at least it was air. Jeddah and the others did the same, breathing deeply and relieved to no longer be stifled by their masks. They still needed the suits, however. Temperature levels were sub-zero, and clouds of low-lying coolant still thronged some parts of the deck, encrusting stanchions and gantries with artificial hoarfrost. Pulling a data slate from a pouch in his atmosphere suit, Makato said,
"According to this, we can take the lifter up 3 levels and come out in cryogenics. If there's anyone still alive on this ship, that's where they'll be."
He tapped the slate, and the haptic implant in his glove blanked away the schematic and transferred it to a retinal lens independent from the suit itself, but worn by Mercato in a circlet around his head. The rectangular lens was transparent and flicked over his right eye, where it displayed the schematic layout of the ship and superimposed it over his current destination. Now he had a living map of their route to cryogenics. Thusly prepared, he moved the column out again.
"How many savior caskets does a vessel this size have?" he asked Utelex, who consulted his data core for the answer. "Between 300 and 500, intended for essential personnel only."
Mercato nodded.
"So there could be as many as 500 souls up there. With the amount of damage this ship has sustained, the amount of time it could have been adrift in the void, I would posit that number to be significantly less. But 500 at most? Potentially, yes."
Mercato began to wonder if he had brought enough men.
Too late now.
He decided they would get to cryogenics, assess the situation, and then determine if further rescue teams were needed. They crossed the remainder of the maintenance subdeck without incident. The lifter was large enough to accommodate the entire team, so they went together. After 3 decks, they reached cryogenics. As the gates to the lifter opened, a long corridor was revealed, stretching away into half darkness. 2 other corridors lay either side of it, but were only accessed through the central aisle, making 5 in total. Mercato's schematic showed each corridor had 2 rows of 50 cryogenic savior caskets. This was the ship's cryo vault, and according to its Chronos stamp, it had not been accessed in several days. 500 souls, Alpha through Epsilon, with the main access corridor marked as Gamma. As they stepped from the lifter and onto the deck threshold, it became clear that not all of the caskets were functional. Some were broken, the activation lumens within dark and non-operational. Each casket was identical, arranged vertically and shaped like a glass cocoon mounted to a power generator slaved to the cryovault's power array. They were large, too, large enough to accommodate a human host with ease. Pipes and tubes fed nutrients and maintained hydration. A simple face mask rebreather provided oxygen. During cryosleep, a host would want for nothing and be left to dream. But some of the inhabitants lodged in this ship's cryo vault had been anything but quiescent. Closer inspection revealed that most of the caskets were empty, but some contained desiccated, even skeletal remains of human crew. None of these men or women had died well. Jeddah made the sign of the Aquila as Mercato led them down the main access corridor. Lamp packs stabbed into the darkness, shining into each casket as their bearers checked for survivors.
"The long sleep," said Mercato, trying not to imagine waking from cryostasis, locked inside one of those caskets, unable to breathe, barely able to move, slowly freezing to death as the process of vitrification broke down. The terror-etched faces, staring hollow-eyed back at him, made it hard to refute the image. Hands curled into claws, scratching ineffectually at glass. Fingertips blue with cyanosis. Lips peeled back over ice-rimmed jaws and teeth. Mouths outstretched in silent expressions of fear and anguish.
"Something very bad happened here," Jeddah murmured. It was the first sign of internal doubt he had shown since mission start.
Mercato found he could not argue, so said the only reassuring thing he could think of.
"Whatever went wrong and condemned these poor souls to a cold death has passed. Stay vigilant."
They moved slow, 2 by 2, with 1 man as rearguard. The air was chill and getting colder by the second. Their breath ghosted in long white plumes of exhalation. The hard deck clanked underfoot with every booted step. Nothing on the schematic.
Are you getting any biosigns, Engineer?
Mercato had left Utilex and the Thalax at the entryway, where a command console was linked to all 500 caskets.
The ship's entire complement of cryogenic stasis caskets has been activated. None are registering life signs, but the control functions of this facility have been compromised.
Compromised? Mercato, Jeddah, and his men were reaching the end of the first bank of caskets. Frost crusted their boots from the expulsion of cryogenic gas leaking from several damaged units that crept across the floor in a white fog.
Sabotaged,
Utilex replied.
Cryo-freezing should not be able to occur if a unit is damaged or its hermetic seal has been breached. This facility is currently violating that protocol.
Hence the air and the frost underfoot. Mercato gripped a support stanchion of one of the caskets to test it. The metal cracked and split with only a minor application of force. Shortness of breath, acute headache, and nausea. Mercato did not need to be a medicus to recognize the early stages of hypoxia.
Helmets on, he ordered, feeling his skin start to prickle.
Encased by the domed glacis, Mercato experienced a stifling of his senses, but the temperature readout on the glass and the increased nitrogen in the air's composition suggested some minor fractional distillation had occurred with the large-scale release of several broken caskets. Prolonged exposure would be harmful to both him and his men. At the end of the first bank, they had discovered 16 operational caskets, another 20 without power, and 14 with hermetic breaches, spilling out cryo gas into the localized atmosphere. 8 had been occupied by members of the crew. All were dead, their stasis arrested or having failed completely. 4 more banks awaited them, but Mercato was growing impatient. As a Navy veteran, he had learned to trust his instincts. Here they were telling him to perform whatever due diligence he needed to in the cryo vault and then get himself and his men off the ship.
Jeddah, split your men into 2 teams and have them cover the port-facing caskets. I'll take the starboard.
Jeddah nodded and went to his task. Mercato went right. Before heading down the next bank of caskets, he checked the load of his carbine. There was frost occluding the ammo gauge, and he had to wipe it with his glove several times before it cleared. He had yet to fire it, so he knew the weapon held a full charge, but the sight of the flashing readout was absurdly reassuring.
Engineer, any life signs? Still none, but I am reading increased heart rate and respiration in your biorhythms, Lieutenant. I'm fine. Just keep your attention on the cryo vault. I don't want any surprises.
The next bank of Syro caskets was dark, and what little light that came from the deck lamps underfoot was obscured by the vaporous atmosphere created by the leaks. About halfway down the corridor, one of the caskets spewed thick gouts of freezing mist into the air from a ruptured pipeline. It was hard to tell in the conditions, but the cable looked as if it had been cut. Giving each casket a cursory examination now as he subconsciously increased his pace, Mercato edged past the badly damaged cryo unit. As he emerged into the latter half of the corridor, a thought occurred to him.
Engineer, what purpose would deliberately flooding the cryo vault with aerosolized nitrogen serve?
It took a few seconds for Utilex to respond. During the short pause, Mercato caught the sound of Jeddah's voice through the muffled confines of his helmet. He was about to raise the armsman on the vox when Utilex replied,
"Other than to create a hypoxic atmosphere, I can think of only one. The obfuscation of genuine active biosignatures within the vault."
Mercato's grip on his carbine intensified and his pace slowed as his heart rate increased. Each casket was an empty void. Most were unlit. The billowing pipeline behind him created a soft, dulcet refrain that scraped his nerves rather than eased them. Explain. If an infiltrator wanted to hide their presence from a rudimentary bioscan, a cryovault with a compromised structural integrity would be the optimum location to achieve that.
Meaning the drop in temperature would effectively make them invisible?
Precisely. What about the effects of prolonged exposure? In most cases, that would result in decreased motive and cognitive function, concluding in death.
Most cases. Makata wanted to hail Jeddah. He wanted to recall his men, but the next cryo-casket in line was frosted with recent activation, the glass almost impossible to see through. Almost impossible. Something loomed behind the glass. It was large.
Lieutenant, Jeddah's voice came over the vox. We found something.
Makata was only half listening as he reached out a gloved hand to wipe away the hoarfrost obscuring his view.
You said most cases. What could survive in conditions like that? He asked Utelex,
whilst simultaneously smearing away the frost on the outside of the casket, creating a half-horseshoe window of clear glass through which to observe.
Only a transhuman subject could survive in a nitrogen-saturated environment for any length of time.
Power armor.
Emperor's blood,
gasped Makato, and backed away. From the opposite end of the cryo-vault, he heard smashing glass and the shouts of Jeddah and his men. Energized carbine discharges followed in a high-pitched whine.
Who is firing? Makato demanded. Jeddah, report!
Jeddah's reply was swallowed up by more las discharge and panicked shouting. Makato dared not turn his back on the cryo-casket. In his peripheral vision, which was limited within the dome of his helmet, he saw a second casket was similarly occupied. In the one directly in front of him, something was moving.
Power armor.
It took him a few seconds to make the connection. Through the gap in the frost, Makato saw the casket occupant's eyes open. They were black, like pools of oil.
Engines here, we're in trouble. Activate the thalux.
Utelex gave a clipped affirmative. At the same time, a gauntleted hand smacked the inside of the casket, forming a crack in the hardened armor glass. Makato raised his carbine and fired a three-round burst almost point-blank into the casket and ran. He went straight through the venting gas and felt it bite, even through the protection of his atmosphere suit. He got as far as the junction when the crash of sundered glass resounded behind him and something heavy fell onto the deck. He did not look back. Jeddah was coming the other way with one of his men. A third shambled into view behind them. There was blood on this armsman's atmosphere suit and a rent in the hardened material through which Makato could see aggressive heat bleed. The armsman staggered two more steps before collapsing face down on the deck. Jeddah kept on running, so did the man with him. Makato did not know their names, only that they were Jeddah's men and therefore Jeddah's responsibility. Faced with what he suspected was in those caskets, Makato felt remiss in not learning those names, that in this moment of peril he had disrespected the lesser armsmen somehow and would now not be able to rectify that. It was strange how much that bothered him.
Where's the other one?
Asked Makato, recognizing his maudlin thoughts as potentially hazardous to his survival, however remote that might be, and pushing them to his subconscious. Maintain focus now, live to repent later. He, Jeddah, and the other armsmen regrouped in sight of the central corridor. The heavy tread of the thalax resonated against the metal as it advanced, but was not particularly comforting. Makato wanted it between them and whatever was coming out of the caskets, but his duty made him go and get his men first.
Dead, Lieutenant, Jeddah replied. They gutted him soon as they came out of stasis. They? How many did you see?
To his immense credit, Jeddah was managing to stay coherent.
Three, I think. The first broke out behind us, killed Haldar. It was slow, still shrugging off stasis, but it tore him apart all the same. We retaliated. I think we wounded it, but a second one came out in front, boxing us in, so I gave the order to retreat.
Jeddah glanced over his shoulder at the face-down corpse a few meters away.
Navar got clipped by the one we wounded.
Halder, Navar, Makata would remember them and would honor their sacrifice if he survived, if any of them survived.
I've got at least two more in banks Delta and Epsilon, he said, then asked the other armsman. What's your name, son?
Barrios, sir,
Barrios answered, a little confused. Strange how the small things mattered when death was crouched within your eyeline.
Are they?
Ventured Jeddah, unwilling to voice the name of their would-be killers aloud. Makato nodded. He had never fought against renegade space marines before. Despite his many years of service to the chapter, the scenario had never come about. No Fireborn would ever even countenance putting a human life in harm's way whilst they could still be that human's shield. It was their creed. But Makato knew what was in that first casket, even though he had only seen a sliver of its identity, a half-glimpsed plastron, an ice-bitten gauntlet. Those pits of night glaring murderously through the frosted glass. Armored in black, with eyes the mirror of their battle plate, there were many renegade warbands who answered that vague description. Makato knew only of a few, but had not seen any iconography or markings to narrow that down. It hardly mattered. All were deadly and beyond he and his depleted squad's current capabilities to kill or even incapacitate. Even the Thalax would struggle to overcome an entire squad of transhumans, but it could slow them down. If Utalex could then seal them in the cryo vault. They were sluggish, Jeddah had said as much. Even transhuman biology would struggle to return to full efficacy after prolonged cryogenic exposure. It had been the perfect camouflage, but had also left them diminished.
What are your orders, sir?
Makato could not have wished for a better soldier than Jeddah. It crushed his pride to think they might all soon be dead.
Thalax is inbound. We get it between us and them. Hold Corridor Gamma until Utalex can seal the cryovault.
Jeddah nodded, and the three of them ran for the central corridor.
The Thalax was immense and easily filled the corridor with its height and bulk. Capacitors in the Cyborganics micro-reactor cycled up to full ionization. Coils along the barrel of the lightning gun, sleeved to its left arm and cradled by the three metal digits of its right, electrified with energized promise. A chainsaw bayonet protruding beneath the rifle's muzzle began to turn. The low hum of the blade became a throaty growl. It halted halfway down the corridor, the single cortex in its skull flaring red, a hound at the extent of its master's leash. Upon seeing the Thalax, Makato slowed almost to a stop, as did Jeddah and Barrios. The voice of the engine seer got them moving again with purpose. It would be unwise to delay, Lieutenant.
Makato got Jeddah and Barrios behind the Thalax a few seconds before the firing began. Glancing over his shoulder as he ran down Corridor Gamma, Makato saw a burst of energy whip from the coiled muzzle of the lightning gun and into an armored warrior who had just stepped into its sights. There was an audible grunt, the strong scent of burned metal as the warrior took a hit that slung him back and slammed him into one of the caskets that then burst apart in a flare of actinic light. A subsequent salvo of shots ignited the muzzle coil moments after the first, as the Thalax reacted to a second combatant. A third came closely on its heels. Both warriors were carrying some kind of blade, but had no firearms to speak of. It was hard to be certain in the half-dark while trying to fight the sudden rush of transhuman dread that Makato felt creeping into his marrow. The shots went wide of the mark, or rather the warrior evaded one and took the other as a glancing hit on his shoulder guard. Makato saw nothing further, as he needed to look back around or would risk colliding with the caskets or one of his men in the rising panic.
When he did turn again, the Thalax had winged the second warrior, but the third was still moving. A fourth, difficult to discern with the air clouded by the corpuscent discharge from the lightning gun, had entered the corridor, but stooped to help his wounded comrade. According to his rough calculation, Makoto reasoned the Thalax had one more shot before the third warrior made up the ground and would be on it. There was still a quarter of the corridor to go. Makoto saw Utalex waiting at the end for them, entering the activation protocols that would seal the cryo vault. When he heard the high-pitched shriek of the lightning gun, Makoto turned. The shot was good, but even wounded, the third warrior swung his blade and forced the Thalax to parry with its bayonet.
"You need to hurry,"
came the voice of Utalex through the vox. Makoto was torn between standing his ground with his carbine and running like hell. They were almost there, but the renegade Astartes were close, and they moved so fast. A fraction too late, he saw Barius turn and aim high with his carbine. A fifth warrior in black armor had mounted one of the caskets like a living gargoyle, but one poised to attack rather than slaved to stone. In front of Makoto, the Thalax had thrown back the third warrior, but the second, who had now recovered, went in hard with his blade. With incredible strength, he slashed apart a cluster of cabling that put the cyborg on one knee as the mechanized equivalent of its tendons was severed. A point-blank burst from the lightning gun sent the warrior reeling, rolling end over end until he struck one of the caskets and it crumpled inwards against his violent impetus. In the same moment, a dark spray flecked Makoto's helmet glacis and atmosphere suit. Barius's abruptly clipped scream revealed what had happened. Something large, much more massive and imposing, up close, landed amongst them. Paralyzed with the same dread he had been fighting ever since seeing what was inside the caskets waiting for them, Makoto could only watch as a black-armored angel of death tore apart what was left of Barius. In the same killing stroke, the warrior seemed to point his gauntleted fingers at Utalex, who had begun to seal the cryovault. Makoto did not even have time to feel anger at this betrayal as the engine seer came apart in a welter of gore and machine components, his blood merging horribly with oil. Slow, so impotently slow, Makoto turned with his carbine. Reacting to its master's demise, the Thalax was turning, too, intent on engaging the engine seer's murderer who had evidently implanted his watchdog with some kind of vengeance protocol. It was ultimately dooming, as with its guard down whilst it took aim at the warrior that had killed Utalex, the other two warriors ripped into the Thalax from behind and destroyed it. Knowing there was no way out now, Makoto put up his hand and lowered his gun. With a glance, he ordered Jeddah to do the same. Seen behind his retinal lenses, the eyes of the warrior who had dropped down on them from the stasis caskets met Makato's.
"Surrender,"
said a guttural voice, deep and harsh as scoured steel.
"A considerably wise move on your part."
Now he saw the warrior up close as it rose to its full awesome height. Makoto saw the blades were not blades as such, at least they were not the kind that are drawn or lacquered or mounted in an armory. They were bone, a living part of the warrior. Bone protruded through his battle helm too, a crest of it that stretched across his entire skull all the way to the nape of his neck, as far as Makoto could tell. He had the rank markings of a sergeant, and Makoto assumed this one was their leader, but carried no visible weapons other than the deadly bone growths. By the way he had torn Utalex apart, Makoto had thought the warrior might be a psyker, but again, as he looked closer, he saw the smaller bone knives embedded in parts of the engine seer's sundered corpse. The two who had cut the thallax apart, severing both arms and legs before decapitating it, joined the sergeant. The three warriors formed a cage of black ceramite around Makato and Jeddah, who had now sunk to their knees. These two had the same bony growths as their sergeant, only shorter and without the crest. One of the warriors, the one Makato had seen through the glass, was without a helmet. His skin was extremely pale, rimmed with frost, the extremities tinted azure with cyanosis. Whether a result of lurking in unprotected and partial cryostasis or some mutagenic quirk, his ears were slightly pointed at the ends, his nose almost beak-like. But it was the eyes that resonated. They were indeed black, as if the pupil had overwhelmed the sclera and clouded the eye with abject shadow. Makato found he could not hold the warrior's gaze and looked away. Before he did, he saw that all three had the silver icon of a snarling dragon on their shoulder guards.
"We are cursed,"
the sergeant told Makato when he saw him looking at the bone growths of him and his men. Makato was no stranger to being around Adeptus Astartes. The awe they inspired with their mere presence was familiar to him. But there was something different at work in the black-armored sergeant. He radiated strength and savagery. Something feral and utterly monstrous lurked behind the faceplate he wore, a mask to contain a beast betrayed by the snarl in his every syllable. There was no pity, no potential for remorse or compassion, only brutality and the prospect of violence. Despite his terror, Makato found the resolve to speak, though his words were uttered as a rasp, through fear-clenched teeth.
"I am Lieutenant Makato of the Chapter Adeptus Astartes, vessel Forge Hammer."
He was surprised at his own defiance. Jeddah's head was bowed, but he raised it upon hearing Makato's proud words. Makato was fifth-generation Navy, and his esteemed heritage extended all the way back into the previous millennium. His was a proud family, a lineage of honor and duty. A silver braid upon his uniform had once belonged to his father, Hiroshimo. Makato had barely known the man, for a life in the Navy is one that seldom comes with the comfort of loved ones, but he still valued that tangible piece of familial legacy like the heirloom it truly was. A ceremonial sword he had in his quarters had once served his grandfather, Yugeti, and though Makato had never drawn it in battle, the blade was still sharp. In the memories of these things lay strength. Makato drew on that, on the legacy of Yugeti and Hiroshimo, and yoked it for the courage it afforded in facing down the monster before him with unyielding resistance. He upthrust his chin imperiously, and the blow came swift, and a starburst of pain flashed behind Makato's eyes a moment later. He tasted blood and felt a raw and aching agony in his face. His atmosphere helmet was gone, smashed loose by the warrior's blow. The realization of that came late, as well as the fact Makato had been knocked onto his face. It had been little more than a slap, but he felt the loose teeth in his mouth and spat out a wad of blood. Jeddah made to rise when the sergeant advanced on Makato, but was roughly put down by one of the other warriors. The sergeant paid the armsman no heed, who was doubled over in pain, several of his ribs broken.
"Leave him!"
snarled Makato in a half-rasp, looking up from all fours as he tried to get back up to his feet, glaring through blurring vision. A second blow put him down again, harder than the first, and he had to stifle a yelp as he felt something break. Makato was determined not to give his aggressor that satisfaction. With the three black-armored warriors looking on impassively, Makato struggled to his knees again and grimaced through a cage of missing teeth.
"I am Lieutenant Makato."
He was struck again. hard enough to send him sprawling this time. Dark shadows crowded at the edge of Makato's vision as he came close to blacking out. Only half-conscious, Makato felt himself seized by a manacle-like fist. The pain of the sergeant's grip was so intense it brought Makato back around.
"I heard you, maggot,"
the sergeant uttered in a low growl.
"I am battle-worn and half-frozen, but not deaf. What do you want?"
Makato could smell the sergeant's fetid breath issuing in a cloud of vapor through his helmet grill as he crouched down to answer. It stank of spoiled meat and old blood. Makato imagined fangs behind that mouth grill. His words came out as a whisper that was more chilling than any battle cry.
"Revenge," he said. "But first, we want your ship."
Makato laughed in spite of his rising terror.
"You are mad. There will be retribution for this."
"Could well be,"
said the sergeant, before he hauled Makato up by the chin, his gauntleted fingers closing vice-like around the lieutenant's neck. The fingers bit flesh, drawing blood. He raised him until his feet dangled off the floor.
"Now hear me. Your courage is misplaced. You want to live, but above that, you want your men to live. I am willing to allow this. The one in the corridor you left for dead, yet survives. So too does the one currently bent double at the feet of my warriors."
The sergeant seized Makato's neck a little harder, spreading his fingers across his lower jaw as he brought him in closer.
"I am Urgaresh of the Black Dragons. You will see us aboard your ship. And on my honor, no further hand will be raised to you. Are we in accord?"
The one who called himself Urgaresh dropped Makato to the deck, who immediately gasped for air as he clutched his throat.
"Your honor," said Makato when he could breathe again.
"How can you speak of honor when you ambushed and killed two of my men?" "We fought. You lost. Do not succumb to vainglorious pride and add to the tally already made. An accord? Do we have one, or must I kill another?"
Urgaresh stepped in close, giving Makato the lightest of kicks to urge him towards a quick answer. Pain flared in Makato's chest, but he was still alive. So was Jeddah. So was Navarre, if what the Black Dragon had said was to be believed. He did not know the name of the warband, what ruinous deities or warmaster they served. Makato only knew he had no choices left. He nodded weakly. Urgaresh stepped back and called to the warrior who had stopped to tend to their injured.
"Thorast, does our brother yet live?"
"He does."
Urgaresh turned back to Makato.
"That is fortunate for you, maggot. Tend the wounded mortal. Stabilize him only,"
he continued to Thorast, though his gaze did not leave Makato, who was kneeling again.
"Get these two fit enough to leave this ship on foot. We are bound for the Forge Hammer then, and a reckoning with the sons of Nocturne."